Episode 46 with Laurel Vogel.
Where meditation meets daily life, this is the Meditation Freedom Podcast.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Meditation Freedom Podcast. My name is Siko Rode, and this podcast is about contemplative practices like meditation and mindfulness and how they help us to become more conscious and grow into wisdom and maturity, and expresses itself through more kindness, more compassion. It's a movement towards inner disarmament, which then results into external disarmament. And this is a process, and of course there's going to be lots of setbacks, and it requires a lot of practice and humility and patience and investment in loss. But the results are increasing circles of compassion and wisdom, and that ripples through, and that helps decrease the violence in this world. Today I'm going to be talking with Laurel Vogel, who is a ecotherapist. And she received her degree in contemplative eco-psychology. She's also a Zen practitioner and a nature immersion group facilitator. And she founded and runs the Holding Earth Sangha on Whidbey Island and conducts nature immersion camps there. Laurel's writing has been anthologized in Rebirths, Conversations with a World and Soul. And she's also written articles for Ecotherapy News and Restoration Earth Journal. So with that, here's the interview with Laurel Vogel. Thank you so much, Laurel, for joining me in this interview.
Thank you for having me.
The way I like to start these interviews is just to get to know you a little bit and your journey into a meditation contemplative practice. So maybe you can tell me a little bit about how you got started or what precipitated your journey in towards a spiritual or contemplative practice.
Well, it's kind of a long story, but I'll try to make it as brief as possible.
Take your time.
Okay. I really have been a spiritual seeker probably from a young age. I started out going into certain faiths when I was pretty much a young kid. The vacation Bible school buses would come around and haul us off to church, and it really opened up my seeking personality. And unfortunately, I could never find a home in that kind of faith. I just couldn't reconcile myself to in those particular traditions. There was this God the Father who would punish people into eternal damnation, and I couldn't reconcile myself with that. So I left that sort of church and continued seeking. As a young adult, I went through many things. And in my 30s, I turned to yoga, and I had a strong yoga practice for a long time. And in my 40s, I started meditating. I went through Vipassana, and then eventually came to Zen practice. That was 11 years ago. And I found that Zen was the one place where I really could have all of my doubts and be exactly who I am, but still have a really strong, containing kind of a practice. And so even though I come with all my questions and my sometimes contentious relationship with spirituality, it can hold that, and it can stand up to that. So I find the non-exclusive nature of that to be as close to a home in a practice as I can find.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you mentioned the judgment of the Old Testament kind of religion, the Abrahamic religions, and then the non-judgment and inclusivity of Zen.
Right. Yeah, I really believe that. I don't really believe anymore that all Christian religions are like that. But I have come to find that, and even all Buddhist sects aren't as inclusive as I would like to think they could be. But for the most part, the one that I've found seems to really embrace, not it doesn't tell me what to think and what to feel and how to be. So I really had to kind of go away from practices that gave me too much by way of prescriptive living. Right. So.
And the preconceived notions, the conditioning that they already have.
Right, right. And of course, there are precepts which we follow, but nothing like you have to believe this way and you have to think this way.
Right, yeah. But there is also a faith element of in Zen as well. How do you relate to that as opposed to, say, accepting something on blind faith?
Well, the faith is to keep practicing, I think, to keep going and to keep sitting and to keep doing the meditation practice. I mean, that's really where the faith comes in, that the process will take us toward, wherever it is we're going. I see that as a little bit different than being told what I need to have faith in.
Right.
I think through the culture we've kind of had certain churches, not all of them, have really come to try to tell people a lot about how to live and what they should do. The particular church I was in for a while, you know, they kind of got into your life from everything from the length of your sleeves to whether or not you should go bowling or swim. So, you know, it's that kind of a context that I was reacting to, I think, when I was looking for a spirituality that was more open and inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Would you say you're still seeking, or are you at this point, is some of that dropping away now that you're more feeling at home in your practice?
In a way, I think I feel at home seeking. I do feel like no matter what I do, I will find a way to be seeking. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. I think it's just part of my nature. And I think that I'm finally coming to a place where I'm accepting that more. That, you know, I just may be one of those people who needs to question everything. And maybe that's just part of my path.
Yeah, right. You're accepting it. Whatever state of mind you are, you're accepting it. And that's a very liberating feeling, right?
Yes, it is. It's very liberating to realize that, you know, no matter where I'm at, I am accepted in this practice as I am with all my questions and doubts. It doesn't mean that I'm somehow not practicing right or doing the right thing.
Right. Yeah, I think it was Shunryu Suzuki who said there really are no mistakes in practice, or it's one big mistake.
Continuous mistake. Yeah.
Right.
That's right. That would about describe my my experience of practice.
How has this practice affected your relationship with the world? And you know, because we're going to go into ecotherapy a little bit later, and that seems like it's very similar to changing your view or your relationship with everything.
Yes. Ecotherapy, the more deeply I go into Zen practice and the more deeply I go into ecotherapy, it seems that the two really seem to dovetail with each other, especially with the ways that I practice ecotherapy. My degree, I actually defined what I was doing as contemplative ecotherapy, which was very much about bringing people into a contemplative, open state in their practices out in nature.
How has it affected your view of, especially in Zen, our the sense of solid self and other? Has that changed over your practice?
I would say definitely. Well, explain to me a little bit more about what you mean by solid self and other.
Yeah, I mean, it's I guess our culture and our conditioning is very much about believing in a separate sense of identity and that I'm here and this person is out there and I end at the limits, at the extent of my skin bag, or my, you know, the ends of my skin.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay, that is a really good point to bring up, that both of the practices I do find are really congruent in the way that they do give me at least a sense that I am interconnected and not separate from the natural world. There really is a mutuality and an interrelatedness in the more that I practice contemplative practice, the more that I kind of dissolve into my sense of nature and the natural world. And that happens when I'm walking in the woods and if I'm engaging my senses. Pretty soon, it kind of feels like I am my senses. Mm-hmm. And I'm not only sensing the world is also sensing me. So there's sort of an what would Thich Nhat Hanh say, an interbeing.
Interbeing, yeah. Binning. Right. Binning. When you started your Zen practice, was there like a moment where you realized, you know, this is the kind of practice that I really want to get into deeper and deepen it?
I think probably it's been sort of a slow dissolving into the practice that I'm mostly in. I'm sort of doing a combination of Soto and now I've started studying in the Aiking tradition, the Diamond Sangha. Mm. And I was doing Vipassana with a Sangha and there was no teacher. And I had a really strong feeling that I needed more guidance. I needed someone who I could really ask questions of and explore things more deeply with in terms of my practice. And I just needed help, basically, to understand some things. And I happened to see a flyer at the local Dharma Hall. This was in Bellingham. And Norman Fisher was coming through town. And I remember attending my first Zen weekend retreat with him. And I got a very strong sense that, well, here's this person who's didn't have a lot of big charisma or some of the things that would scare me away from particular teachers. And so I really felt like I could connect with him. And I pretty much jumped in at that point and became his student. And I've practiced with him almost 11 years now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How do you practice with him? Isn't he in San Francisco or...?
He is. He's in Marin County. But at the time when I started, he was coming up to the Bellingham area and Vancouver, British Columbia, about six times a year, and sometimes seven. And so I would catch all of those retreats. And sometimes I would go to California for some of those, too. He has decreased his time up here lately, so I think that was part of the reason I also started looking at going to other practice places.
Maybe you can explain a little bit about retreats, what they do for you that practice on your own cushion at your own house or with a local group wouldn't necessarily accomplish or give you.
Okay, so the experience of Sesshin, the extended 8-day retreats that we have, sometimes 6 to 8 days, are really immersions in the practice where you come together with different Sangha members and you live with them, you move with them, you cook with them sometimes, you do everything together and as one body. And for me, it really increases both my sense of belonging and the feeling of being supported and supporting others, because there's always many, many opportunities for service in those practices. And, you know, some of these people I have barely spoken a sentence to, but I feel very close to them. And so that's part of it, part of why that's important. But it's also just the structure of the schedule. Having all of the constraints of your life removed for a time, or all of the things that are calling you or pulling you out of yourself, and really just getting a chance to not have to make decisions and not have to do the usual life that you do. And you know, you just get to be contemplative, and that in itself is a real possibility for opening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And do you have like moments that you can recall, maybe some retreat where you had a big insight that you think you might not have gotten if you hadn't gone into an immersion, like you call it?
I would say almost every retreat I have something like that. I don't know. There's just something about being away from my life that really is conducive toward that kind of thing. At one point, I went to a practice period at Green Gulch down in Marin County, and that was really conducive toward some openings. I mean, because not only are you relating to yourself in a practice place, but you are also relating to a lot of people and a lot of different personalities. And so there's a lot of opportunity to kind of look at your habits and patterns. And for me, one of my big patterns is resistance. And so I almost always get a chance to really look at the ways I'm resisting following the schedule, or whether I like it that people wear robes or not, those kinds of things.
Right.
Do you have a
funny example of that?
I don't know if it's funny. It's just part of my contentious nature. I'd have to think on that.
No, that's all right. It's just sometimes it's funny when we look at ourselves and our habit patterns, and there are times when it's really annoying, like you mentioned, and serious. Yeah. But then there are times when you just, you know, it's like it becomes almost comical.
Yeah, I guess that is pretty much it. It became funny to me that I do spend so much time just resisting and not just allowing myself to follow the schedule. I mean, obviously I'm there for a reason, and I'm putting myself in that position, that pressure cooker, you know, of sesshin for a reason. So it's a little funny that I would then come kind of come up against this part of my personality that you know, I have authoritarian issues. So, you know, I'm going to map authority onto everybody. So it could be funny sometimes if we know how to laugh at ourselves. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Robert Aiken, who was our teacher's teacher, and he has a story where he called his whole sesshin my damn mother or something. You know, he was like his whole sesshin, he was brewing about some issues he has with his mother. And it can happen like that. A whole sesshin that you have one issue that seems to be taking the dominant position.
Yeah. I've had many such sesshin. Yeah. And it can be something that happens even as I'm walking into the sesshin, you know, that I decide I need to obsess about for a while. You know, I've only really, after 11 years, I've only really gotten to the point where I'm much better at dropping the stories and just, okay, that there's another one and I can let that go now. I really think it's recent for me. You know, I'm kind of hard-headed, so it took me a while.
Yeah, well, I think most of us have some habits that are easy to slide off and to let go, and then there are others that are much more deeply ingrained and much harder to let go of. And then somebody else might look at us and say, well, that's easy. I can drop that. But then they might have something that would be easy for us to let go of, a story or a narrative or.
Yeah. All depending on our sort of inheritance from our particular upbringing or culture or whatever we have to deal with. Right.
And then when you come back out into the busyness of life, how does a retreat then affect the way you your attitude or your the way you attend to your regular life when you come back out of a retreat? How does that affect your regular life?
That's a good question. At first, I used to be bothered because, regardless of how many perceived openings I may have had, I was disappointed in myself because I was supposed to be all peace and love now, right? years ago, I would think that, And eventually that wore off and I stopped trying to be something once I left retreat. And what I find is that it's just more of a, I mean, I think it particularly work practice and certain of the moving practices are helpful in this, that all of a sudden you find you're coming back to your mindfulness while you're washing the dishes, or you are remembering to be mindful while you're walking through the woods, or you remember it when you're driving the car. And it's not really like something I was able to consciously bring from Sesshin into my daily life. It's just more something that kind of happened as a result of consistently going.
Right. We keep doing the practice, but then at some point the practice does us. And so it just kind of carries wherever you go.
I think that's it. Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Do you have an example of maybe where, you know, where you notice that in your daily life, maybe it's in traffic or maybe it's, like you said, cooking or, mm-hmm. and how do you then suddenly become aware of that?
I'm not sure how it happens. I think maybe it was Jack who said something about using those experiences kind of like mindfulness bells when something difficult happens, or something alarming happens, or like the neighbors using a leaf blower. That's one of my favorite ones. I can use that experience to think of it as a mindfulness bell and bring myself back when I remember. And I do think as a result of, you know, pretty intense practice, I've come to where I can do that more often and remember to do it more often.
And then when you come back, that changes your relationship to the leaf blower at that point, or what happens then?
Sometimes. Sometimes I can drop the story that I have about, you don't need to know the story, but I guess it does. Because if I don't do that, I really can be agitated for a long time. And if I do that, then I can really go somewhere else and focus on something different.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, that's nice the way you put that. And, you know, I bet a lot of people want to understand how that works.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I understood it better, but I really do think practice makes it happen. I don't know how else to explain that. I don't think we can try, you know. It's like you said, the practice practices us eventually.
Yeah, and that's great. And something de-escalates then, or becomes less tight and constricted, it sounds right. Like from what you're explaining.
Yeah, and the heart opens up a little more to the other person. You know, and this happens all the time in human relationships. You know, you get that email with a tone that you're uncertain about, and at first you feel like, oh, that person is saying such and such, and then if you can, instead of reacting, take mm-hmm. a break, there's another mindfulness bell, and then come back to it, you can kind of let go of the story that you have about that person. Maybe it's someone you've had conflict with in the past, and you can maybe see it as something, I can see it as something that, you know, oh, that was my trigger. That was my own personal psychology at work there. I can now let go of that and just deal with this person who has their own particular way of seeing the world also.
Yeah, that's great. And that really then has the ability to create a new opening in that relationship too, and de-escalation and maybe a new appreciation.
Yeah, it's so often that we're encountering others through, you know, the lens of, I mean, I don't know how else we would encounter others except for through our own stories, but the more we can kind of discern between what is my story and what is your story, the more potential there is for like an authentic meeting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe this is a good point at which we go a little bit into ecotherapy, and how did you come about that, and maybe tell a little bit about what it means and why you decided to explore that?
Well, you know, I grew up as a barefoot kid, running around climbing trees, and at some point that got closed off and shut down, probably, you know, age 13, 14, 15, whenever that happens. And I kind of moved indoors, and probably a lot of things going on in my own personal life, my own family life. And then when I was, I believe I was 24, 25, I was married at the time to someone, and he decided we needed to go down the Grand Canyon. And I didn't want to go. I kind of had pulled away from nature in this way that I was really unaware of. But I went because, you know, they bought the ticket and I had to go, he and his friend. And so we went down into this canyon, and I had been afraid of everything in nature. You know, like some young women are. And I was a bit fragile around it. So I was taken into the Grand Canyon, and it was sort of this process of stripping away culture for me. Here we were down in the canyon. We entered in at Lee's Ferry, where most people do, and we had these oarsmen who were sort of wild men, and it was cold and rainy, and I hated it, and I just thought this was the worst thing in the world. How am I going to get through this? And by the time we had to hike out of Bright Angel, because we only had half of a pass, or half of a trip that we were able to get onto. And by the time we hiked out, I didn't want to go. I was begging my husband and friend to let me stay and go on down the river with the rest of the guides. Something happened to me in that canyon. I think it was just the awakening of my senses. I was, you know, touching rock. I was seeing wildlife. I was feeling the river. You know, there was the sky, the sun. It was just, we were open and in nature. And I had not really seen or felt what I had been missing.
Wow.
And so that experience stayed with me, and I started going camping a lot more. I went back to the canyon, just became much more the person I think I was supposed to be. And eventually that relationship ended, and I went back to school, and eventually my schooling culminated in a degree in eco-psychology, because I was very interested in the field of psychology, but not so much being in an office in a confined room just with one other person, which I tried to do for 3 years. And basically eventually ended up taking my practice back to ecotherapy and eco-psychology and practicing in context with the world.
So for someone who's not familiar, what would be the main difference between eco-psychology and ecotherapy?
Well, eco-psychology is kind of the academic field that I'm in, and ecotherapy is the way that it's practiced.
So it's applied, basically.
Yeah, it's applied eco-psychology. There may be some other nuanced differences, but they're a bit academic. But I like the term ecotherapy because it's readily understandable, and it kind of gets away from the word psychology. So,
How does that work if somebody... Is somebody just call you because they know they have an eco or a nature deficit type of issue, or how does that work? Do they get referred to you?
I do have some referrals with people who, with therapists in the area who think that it would be beneficial for their clients. A lot of work is coming out in hospitals now that this is a good adjunct to certain illnesses that people have, how people come, you know, that's probably one of the biggest challenges in this field is how to help people see the difference between doing ecotherapy or going to a therapist's office. We have found that working with other groups or with other types of things is the best way to go. one of the things I do is I write a lot about the topic. I've used to write for Ecotherapy News, and I've written for Restoration Earth Journal, and I have something anthologized in an anthology about the topic. And so that's one area where it's a big educational piece, you know. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And to try to join it to other things, like the other thing that I'm doing is when we started our Zen practice group here, we are moving it toward becoming a green sangha, probably introducing a little bit of Thich Nhat Hanh's materials, because he has the holding earth idea.
Mm-hmm.
So the green sangha is another way that we do this. And we're taking people camping so that... my husband's a psychotherapist, and he works with couples. So one of the things we'll do is take couples out. And this is a really great way to work with couples, combining his marriage counseling with the ecotherapy. It kind of gives it a context, and it also gives them something to kind of hang what they know about therapy, and yet we can do it outside in nature. And so they like that piece of it. They feel like they're getting something that they know about, and they're also going to get to go kayaking or, you know, whatever it is we've concocted to help them experience nature.
Right. And so if you have somebody, you know, like you, yourself at an earlier age who could use ecotherapy, what would you, what would it be like to take this person? You mentioned kayaking, but what else, what other things do you do to help someone reconnect and change their relationship with themselves and nature?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, I have a 6-part series that I do with people. So there's 6 sessions. And what I've done is I've really extracted some Buddhist ideas and having to do with the senses, and I've also combined that with something called Shunjin Yoku, which is a Japanese forest immersion practice. That's spelled Shinrinyoku, I think. And it is a way of using... really the sense roots, if you've studied like the Abhidharma in Buddhism. And the sense roots would be the eye and sight, ear and sound, you know, nose and smell.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've taken each of these senses and made a practice that they can do out in while we're outside, partly together and partly on their own. So they can do their own little micro quest with the particular practice and really help. They're helping themselves open that particular sense up. And then these build on each other. And eventually we get to the 6th, which is the mind. And, its domain is thinking. So mind and thinking. And that would be the one we culminate this initial series with.
And so the mind typically in the West is pretty much the primary organ that's being attended to, or that everybody pays attention to, which is why it's so dominant, right?
Yes.
So how do you treat that mind in your therapy session?
Well, first of all, we distract from the mind by taking people out. One really good way to do it is get people out of their shoes and just get them sensing and touching and feeling. And in that process, you know, dropping stories about, you know, just coming into really direct visceral contact. And then eventually when you get to seeing the mind as yet another sense route, you know, you get that you can also see thinking as something that is like a sense. You can drop it.
What are you seeing people's reaction to that? Do they have any offer resistance to that?
You know, some people are resistant, just like me. And, you know, very often people experience, you know, I can't really talk about individuals, but I can talk about people I have paid attention to lately outside of my practice. And I find that they experience a sense of joy in the connection that they, when they have a contact with something wild or something that's not in their normal domain, and when they feel their relationship, their mutuality with that other being, that more than human being. And I think this really sparks in us both what's missing from our lives and our need to reconnect. And it instills a desire, hopefully, to continue these reconnection practices.
Right. And so do you give them assignments to go out every day a little bit and reconnect with those senses, or how does that work?
Yeah, ideally they'll be doing that. And, you know, one person that, I guess I can talk about this one. One person said, you know, she passed up her porch swing every day for the last 3 years. They'd put in this beautiful porch swing. And after the retreat, she was just adamant that she was no longer going to do that. She was going to go and enjoy her porch swing. Yeah. You know, other people have different experiences. It brings up, like, we had a couple kayaking, and it brought up their relationship difficulties. And they were able to sort through some of those things. You know, one person needs to steer on the rudder in the back, and the other person needs to paddle, and they need to paddle in unison with each other for this thing to work. And so, you know, they're metaphors that can actually happen in the process of taking people out on adventures.
Right. So it gives them insight about where they're stuck in their relationship.
Yes, it did. And then actually my own husband and I, we got some insight into it on that trip too.
That's great.
Yeah.
What kind of illness, mental illnesses or things are particularly benefited by doing ecotherapy?
Okay, well, there is a lot of research actually coming out for those who are inclined to the Western way of thinking. There's a ton of research coming out right now, mostly like from places like Great Britain and Scotland and Ireland and Finland, and they are showing, you know, actual, you know, I hate to say it, but quantifiable effects. It for decreases in anxiety and depression, increased immune function. They're finding that people who exercise outdoors, they do what they call green exercise. This is in the UK or Great Britain, but it actually helps people have better stamina when they're outside working out. They found a reduction in ADD symptoms, that focus is improved from experience and contact with nature, and even things like improvement in self-esteem and that sort of thing.
That's great. Yeah, you can't go wrong with that.
Yeah you can't.
I saw one study that in University of Essex said that a walk in the country reduces depression in 71% of participants.
Yeah, exactly.
So the challenge is right now is that not everyone is aware that this is such a solution that people can use right now. They can go outside.
Yeah, and it's a challenge because I think people can kind of get bored after a while if they don't really understand how to connect outside, because we're sort of out of practice, and we've also been conditioned by a culture that really sort of needs us to be dependent, I think, on what it gives us, you know, constant stream of entertainment, media, maybe sugar, things like that.
Right.
Things I struggle with anyway. And so I think this dependence on this culture kind of detracts from our ability to go out and fully experience the subtleties that nature has to offer. And also, I don't think we understand how much reciprocity there is in nature, that it's actually giving to us, you know, as well as us giving to it,
mm-hmm.
Her or him, whatever. Yeah, there's so much to this.
Yeah, and like you said, I don't see Facebook anytime soon asking people to go outdoors because they do not want people to leave their platform and their sugar and whatever else is being sold right now.
Right, and I think that's where mindfulness helps, and having a little bit of stamina to sit and stay with something. You know, there's a good story about, I don't know if you know who Eve Ensler is.
Yeah.
She wrote the Vagina Monologues. Well, in one of her more recent books, it's called In the Body of the World, she talks about her experience of getting cancer. And she ended up in a hospital. And after treatment, she was so debilitated, she didn't have the strength to watch TV or, you know, check her text messages or do any of the things that we would ordinarily do to distract ourselves from the pain that we're in. And in her hospital room out the window, she could see this tree. Now, this is a person who left a rural area for New York City and said she hated trees and she wasn't going back. And so here she is, you know, kind of stuck in her own situation with no other outlet and this tree. And there's sort of a beautiful distillation of this story on Brain Pickings, if you ever...
That's a good site.
Look at that. Yeah, about what happens to her as she interacts from her hospital room with this tree, you know, just staring at the bark day after day and getting to know the bark and then just staring at the shiny leaves. And then at nearing the end of her stay, the tree blooms. And it had a profound impact on her. She really found a lot of healing, both emotionally and, you know, metaphorically. She was really able to understand, you know, her relationship to the tree and all that had happened. And also, again, as she was fighting cancer to her own body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really great story and a really good example. And you see these stories and examples in the literature, like Derek Jensen's book, A Language Older Than Words, his own story of childhood sexual abuse by his father and the ways that his relationship to his father and the mirror of what we're doing to the culture plays out in that book and his own personal healing. And, you know, the more recent book called H's for Hawk about grieving the death of her father. Ellen MacDonald was the writer of that one. Beautiful stories about, you know, the ways people interact with nature and find the really deep spiritual, emotional, and physical healing, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Ideally, we would teach this ability to recognize that at an earlier age than on somebody when somebody's got cancer, right?
Right. Yeah.
So how do you think that's going to happen in the future?
Well, little kids already have this, and humans in general already have this knowledge. And to me, it seems that what we're doing is we're training them out of it, and so. It's a really good question. I do believe that we are seeing more. You know, my ear is attuned to hearing stories about nature. And I was at a writing retreat last weekend, and many of the stories that people were compelled to tell each other had to do with, well, there was a squirrel dragging a giant mushroom around, and this is at a retreat center that's in the woods, so there was a lot of nature around, and they were able to go out and walk. And another story I heard was, a deer was chasing a coyote. And, you know, just one story after another about their interactions with nature. And so it gave me some hope that people are interested in. And, you know, when you hear people tell stories like that, and you listen to them, you're hearing something about their longing for what is wild and what is no longer not so domesticated, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if somehow we can speak to this longing that they have, we can help turn people toward, well, you know, yes, this is our desire to be back in relationship with the natural world. And, you know, if I am trying to do this on all the fronts that I can think of to do, I think people know it. They don't really know how to do it. And so that if I can get someone in the door, then we can work from there. But there, you know, we have to write about it. We have to, you know, blog about it. We have to talk about it. And I love taking people out and just immersing them in it. And that, you know, that's what happened for me. And I think that's a really good way to support somebody to sort of peel off those layers that they've gathered from the culture.
Right. Yeah. And the kind of wall that's been built up between them and nature.
Yes.
To take down that wall.
Yeah. To take it down or play with it. Or, I mean, there are many things we can do to interact with it in a way that, you know, helps it come down.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. Do you have any remaining thoughts on, you know, somebody listening who might be able to benefit from nature? Maybe some remaining ideas that they can explore and reconnect?
Pay attention to those moments when you encounter wildness and pay attention to what that feels like. I was walking around in the Arboretum in Seattle the other day, and I encountered a young couple who had just gotten really close to a great blue heron, and they didn't even know what it was. And they came out of that, and they had this delight on their faces, and I questioned them a little bit about it. And, you know, it was clear that they didn't have a lot of contact with nature, but they were so happy that they got to see this this bird up close. So I would say really attend to and pay attention to those moments. It's really important that we all sort of recover and bring rich non-human environments into our lives to learn as much as we can about it. You know, whether this is gardening or you're a photographer, you're a beautiful photographer. And
Thanks. This
is an activity that gets you to put your shoes on and get out the door. And we need something like that in our lives that not only gets us out, you know, taking a walk in the woods and enjoying it, but something that will, you know, really motivate you, like whether it's gardening or, you know, kayaking or something, you know, that just makes you want to do it, because that's going to give you the long sustained contact that will start to get you thinking in a different way. And to experience your own kind of wild nature, and to also experience the domesticity, how domesticity is affecting your life. Because if you do that, you're not going to be able to tolerate, you know, animals that are, you know, caged or in factory farms.
Right.
It's going to wake up the heart, because there's a lot in the natural world that wants to speak to us, you know, if we can develop these ears to hear.
Exactly. Yeah. That's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Thank you so much, Laurel, for talking about ecotherapy and your practice. I hope you enjoyed this interview episode with Laurel Vogel, and you can find the episode by going to meditationfreedom.com/46. And as always, there's a pretty extensive transcript, some links, and feel free to leave a comment or suggestion for other interviews. And if you enjoy this podcast, I would encourage you to go to wherever the podcast you're downloading it from, whether that's Google Music or iTunes, and maybe leave a quick review. Even if you just leave a few stars or a one-sentence review, it helps other people determine whether or not this podcast is interesting to them. So thank you so much for listening to this podcast, and I hope your practice is going well and you take time to recharge. Well, have a great rest of your week or weekend, and talk to you later. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining us on the Meditation Freedom Podcast, where meditation meets daily life.